This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
A central theme, I hope, runs through it is the ultimate unknowability of another human being, but through the course of trying to know another human being, learning what's in your own heart.
That's novelist Russell Banks. We'll be talking with him about his new book, The Reserve, as well as with novelist Tamima Anam.
I really wanted to write a novel about how ordinary people survived this war. What happened to them, how they were changed, how their relationships with one another were changed.
That's all coming up on Writer's Voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest Russell Banks' new novel, The Reserve, is part love story, part murder mystery. Taking place in 1936, not long before the Second World War, the novel explores questions of class, politics, art, love, and madness. Set in an exclusive wilderness enclave held by families of New York's highest society as a vacation playground, the novel's action follows what happens when two intertwined couples violate social conventions and their own morals to follow the dictates of their hearts. Russell Banks is one of America's best-known novelists. He's the author of many books, including Affliction, Cloud Splitter, and The Sweet Hereafter, which was made into a movie directed by Adam Egoyan. Banks is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and his work has received numerous international prizes and awards. He lives in upstate New York. Well, Russell Banks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you were born in New England, and
right.
On your publisher's website, it says you were born into a hardscrabble working-class world.
Well, that's publisher language. Cover copy, I guess, yeah. Well, I was born into a working-class family, I mean, that had been for generations. Working people in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and before that in Canada and the eastern provinces.
Now, and a common theme that runs through your novels is that of class.
Mm-hmm.
And now this one, The Reserve, is no exception, but whereas the others are usually centered on the lives of working class protagonists, The Reserve is centered largely on the blue bloods.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? You know, although it's certainly placed side by side with working people. I mean, it's set in the Great Depression, and one of the themes I was trying to work with is the sort of relatively infrequently dramatized conflict between those who weren't really touched by the Depression, the patrician families of Manhattan, Philadelphia, the Northeast generally, and those who were destroyed by the Depression, which were mostly working people. So that's very much a central theme in the book, and one of the four main characters, because it is a kind of four-hander, is very much a local working man. The other three are from away, as they say.
And that's Hubert Saint-Germain.
Right.
Yeah, he's a really beautifully drawn character, and I want to get into talking about him more in the book as we get more into it. But first, as you said, this is set in the Depression. It is set on the Reserve. Give us a picture of this place.
Well, it's like a number of these organizations, really. They're corporate organizations in the Northeast, and not just in upstate New York, but also in northern New England as well, formed by a number of wealthy people who bought vast tracts of land, very inexpensively, beautiful wilderness, and have preserved it. And they often have camps, so-called, residences built, summer residences built on them, and sometimes lovely clubhouses, golf courses, all kinds of wilderness recreational facilities and so forth, tennis courts. They are, in a way, pleasure palaces in the wilderness. And they appeared first in upstate New York in the end of the 19th century, when sort of the captains of industry were looking for a way to get to the wilderness, which had disappeared more or less from the east, without having to go all the way west. And the Adirondacks beckoned, as did the White Mountains of New Hampshire and Mount Desert Isle in Maine, places like that.
And these are fairly large.
Yes, they range from 10,000 acres to 50 or 75 or even 100,000 acres in this part of the country.
Well, to the book itself now, as you say, it's a four-hander. You've got the four-hander and two couples, I would say.
Right.
One of the main protagonists is Vanessa Cole. She's a beautiful, flamboyant, kind of magnet-to-men person. She always seems to be playing herself as a character.
Right. And that's very good, yes, that's true.
Yeah, and so I actually wanted to read just something from the book, speaking about herself, and I'm just going to read something, and I'd like to have you comment on it. She says that she wasn't like other people, and she knew it. She hadn't chosen this plight exactly. It seemed to have been thrust upon her. It was as if her personal and public past and future were not real, as if her past could be constantly altered and her future indefinitely postponed. She was free to start her life over again and again, daily, if she wished. But by the same token, she had no alternative. Tell us something about her, and particularly in connection with this view of her.
Mm-hmm. She plays a part in the book of the femme fatale. I mean, the book is in a sense, an homage to the noir novel. And although it's not set in a city like New York or Los Angeles, it's set in this wilderness area. But it has a lot of the elements of the noir in it, and deliberately so. She's the femme fatale. That's one level. But on another level, psychologically, I was really trying to sympathetically engage with a character whose behavior would put us off. We would think of her as narcissistic, and even in a psychological way, I mean, in terms of a borderline personality disorder, narcissistic, not just in the metaphoric sense. But I wanted to engage her sympathetically and go to her interior life and to her past and her childhood and see her as a wounded person, so that we would understand her behavior, which would otherwise, despite her beauty and her attractiveness and her intelligence and skill at manipulating people and so forth, we would find difficult to engage and to feel sympathetic towards. It's a type of person that doesn't appear often in literature except in a satiric mode, you know, in a dismissive way. And I don't feel that's altogether useful. I prefer to think about her and people like her in a more sympathetic way. And it's not always easy. But that's what I was getting at right in that paragraph there that you read. That's a kind of almost metaphysical plight that distinguishes her, Vanessa, and people like her from the rest of us, if you will. And if it's presented clearly enough and I hope insightfully enough, and sympathetically enough, then perhaps we can go someplace where we wouldn't normally go with our own compassion and understanding.
You did it very well, because I found that I shifted from not liking her at all to having a kind of tentative sympathy with her, which was what I think is a lot of people's reactions to borderline personalities. I mean, these are folks who often feel a great emptiness within, are not really sure who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out often in real life from a history of childhood abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, or it seems to, in her own family. Mm-hmm. Would you like to say something about that?
Yeah, well, it's the big secret that in her life. And it's also partially a secret that's kept from her as well. And so she's reacting to it all her life without really knowing about it or understanding it or being able to get it. And part of the unfolding of the story is the gradual revelation of what really happened to her in her childhood, filling out, I guess, the outlines and the shadows that she already knew. And she can't really make it known to anyone else either. And that's part of the dilemma she's caught in. And she's not quite believed either by, you know, by Jordan Groves, the man who's falling in love with her, by her mother, she's not really believed. So when you're not really believed about something that you believe yourself occurred to you, you question your own memory, your own experiences. And so that's part of what's going on with her. And if you, as you read it, you're struck by the vagaries of it, and you wonder, well, did this really happen or didn't it really happen? You, as a reader, are getting closer and closer to her perceptions of it, too, I think. And then it's only towards the very end where I think the reader knows more than Jordan Groves or any of the other characters or than her mother, and knows in some ways more even than she knows.
We're speaking with Russell Banks about his newest novel, The Reserve. Now, you mentioned Jordan Groves. He's the character of a celebrated artist who lives on the edge of the reserve, and he's drawn to her. Now, he's a leftist, and he doesn't come from a wealthy background. He's married to a foreigner, but he does depend on the Republican elite of the reserve for his bread and butter. I wonder if you could talk about the tension between who he feels he is and what his life is really like.
Yeah, I got fascinated, when I started thinking about the 1930s and artists and intellectuals and writers of that era who were almost always on the left, some of them on the very radical left, artists like Rockwell Kent and writers like John Dos Passos and even Hemingway and Edmund Wilson and people like that. On the one hand, they were identifying with and sympathetic with and defending the oppressed and the poor and the working people of America and of the world, and running off and joining the Republican forces in the Spanish Civil War and so forth. On the other hand, their social milieu and their fans, their readers, and the people who bought their paintings, the people who supported them economically, were very much from the grandees of the era, the elite. Hemingway and Dos Passos are hanging out with Sarah and Gerald Murphy on the Riviera, or traveling with Nancy Cunard and so forth. So this double bind, in a way, that artists, successful artists particularly, on the left end up in is one that struck me. And also I started thinking about it today. I mean, even today, I mean, writers like Yale Doctorow, Tony Kushner, or even myself, perhaps, have this divide where, we live on the edge of the reserve. I liked your phrase there. Jordan Groves lives on the edge of the reserve. In many ways, so do I. So does Yale Doctorow. So does Tony Kushner. So does Harold Pinter. This is an interesting moral quandary and a painful one, I think, for a lot of people. And so I was trying to get to that and through this character, Jordan Groves, based rather loosely on Rockwell Kent, the artist who was who lived and worked most of his life right near where I live in the Adirondacks. I have a house right in the heart of the Adirondacks that I spend 6 months a year at, and Rockwell Kent lived right down the road and is still a kind of legendary figure there, partly because of his red-tainted politics, but also because he was a famous artist and he was very wealthy and internationally celebrated and so forth.
Could you say more about that moral dilemma and how you resolve it in your own mind, or at least approximate resolving it?
Well, it forces you to confront the fact that as an artist, as a writer or painter or an artist of any type, you are really kind of excluded from being a member of any class. You live on the edge of the reserve. I'm going to come back to that phrase because I thought it was so apt. And you look both ways. And, for most of my career up to now, or at least until maybe the last novel, The Darling, I really kind of only looked one way. I looked maybe backwards into my youth and childhood and my family and my background, as it were. And I didn't look the other way until the last couple of books, or maybe the last 5 or 10 years. And so I've tried in this book really to look the other way as well and realize that I stand right on the line between the two as a man, just as a person. And I think an awful lot of us do who have politics that lead us to identify and sympathize with those who are deprived and poor and oppressed and working people. on the one hand, and yet who are ourselves empowered and educated and affluent by comparison, and who depend upon the sympathies and the education and the entitlement of our readership or the people who buy our paintings or go to the music we play and so on.
And there's also the added aspect that the reason you're in the position you're in and the reason that Jordan Gross is in his position is by virtue of his art. And
right.
In some way, the artist is always standing at the edge of the reserve.
Right, exactly.
But now back to those who are within, firmly within the reserve, Vanessa Cole's father, he's an interesting figure also because when the book starts out, you feel a little more sympathetic for him because after all, he's invited this artist, Jordan Groves, in. You have a sense that maybe he's more sensitive of a person. But then you find out that, in fact, I guess he's loosely modeled on Dr. Walter Jackson Freeman.
I had him in the back of my mind, yes.
And he was the person who performed the first lobotomies in the United States and perfected the technique.
Right.
Something that most of us look upon with horror.
Mm-hmm.
So could you say something about this character and why, was there any special reason you made him a lobotomist?
I just grew fascinated by the idea of invading another person's mind surgically. It's almost like a metaphor for me and a very powerful one and what turned out to be useful. I could have made him any number of different professions, but that one seemed like a very particularly powerful metaphor for the taking over of another person's life, which is what he does with his daughter, and he's the kind of person for whom who feels empowered to do that by virtue of his own, as he sees it, intellectual, scientifically trained superiority. Which wasn't uncommon. It still isn't to say uncommon amongst people of a certain ilk.
Now, back to kind of the storyline of this. Then you have this relationship developing between Vanessa Cole and Jordan Groves, but you have another relationship. You basically have two adulterous relationships in the book, one of which takes an awful long time to actually get to consummation, but feels more adulterous than the second one. The second relationship is between Jordan Groves' wife,
Alicia,
and this character, Hubert Saint-Germain. And he's the non-elite exception. He's a really fascinating character, I find, very, very different from everyone else. He's the Adirondack guide.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about him.
Well, he's a man, he's a kind of a archetype, I suppose, the stoical man of the wilderness, the woodsman, appears very early on in American literature in Cooper and reappears over and over again all the way up into contemporary Western movies, and we always have that kind of stoical, grim, long-suffering man of intelligence and sensibility who's most comfortable in the wild, in the forest, and in a way is a most comfortable one alone, too. A man with a stormy interior life and a very quiet and placid exterior.
Taciturn.
Yeah. And skillful. A man with great skills that are hard-earned. So he's a kind of archetype, but he's also just as an individual human being. I liked him. I liked how he saw himself as a professional, as someone just outside the... He didn't feel like he was a servant to these people, that he had a profession that was passed down for generations, and that of being a guide and a woodsman. And I felt great affection for him. And sadness, too, because it was not clear to him until very late in the game that, in fact, he was a servant for these folks. And no matter how they might romanticize him and sentimentalize him, his life, nonetheless, he was in their employ and making it possible for them to have the, quote, wilderness experience.
And that's part of the trajectory of loss that you talked about in the beginning of the folks in that region who suffered so much during the Depression. How does what happened to him or his profession fit into that?
Dependency, really. He doesn't want to and doesn't acknowledge his dependency on the outsiders and on their love of luxury and fantasy, their need for this fantasy, until the very end. And his relationship with Alicia, you know, with whom he falls in love and bears his soul to her in a way he hasn't or wouldn't to anyone else, makes him vulnerable and wounded in the end when she withdraws. So, I guess that he's playing out a part that's specific to his class in many ways, but also, I hope, you know, is very specific to his character, too.
The novel is The Reserve, and we're talking with its author, Russell Banks. He struggles a great deal with trying to be a good human being, the whole moral dilemma. And I think there are a number of moral dilemmas in this book there that do center around, a number of things. Obviously, the adulterous affairs, also, you know, what happened to Vanessa, her own actions toward her own mother, and I'm not going to be giving away a lot of things here. I'm just going to let the listeners imagine. But could you talk about the moral struggles of the characters as being a touchstone for the book?
Well, I think each of them, all four in his and her way, are trying to be a good person, trying to be good, you know, in a very basic and fundamental way. Jordan Groves he's reckless, and he's an adventurer, and he's a philanderer on the one hand. He also is trying to be a good father and a good husband, and he's failing at it. And he's confused about what he's entitled to do and what he's not entitled to do with regard to his marriage. And when he's betrayed by his wife and she has this adulterous affair with Hubert, he's profoundly confused, and he examines it. The other thing about I like about the characters myself is that all four of them examine themselves. They're pretty scrupulous about that. They don't go blindly into the night. They go slowly and in a self-examining and questioning way. And even Vanessa, who seems on the surface of things to be so impulsive and sometimes even out of touch with reality, nonetheless is questioning herself at every step of the way and searching for something she can never really know, the truth. So each of them, and of course they're all dealing with lies. They all have secrets and lies that they are struggling with.
And it didn't feel to me that the affair between Hubert and Alicia was on the same order of adultery as the one that Jordan has with Vanessa.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's probably because we see Alicia as being a wife who's really, truly neglected. We see her as a victim at first. We don't realize that she's having this affair until about a third of the way into the book. And we see this husband of hers who's notorious, who's a subject of much gossip in papers and in cafe society in Manhattan and other parts of the world, even as a famous womanizer. And he's public about it. So I think we sympathize with her and feel badly for her, so that when we find out she is having this affair with Hubert, we probably cheer a little bit for her, whereas it's not quite the same. The other thing is, too, I think the heat and the light that's generated sexually by the connection between Vanessa and Jordan is somewhat different than the kind of comfort and intimacy that is provided in the relationship between Alicia and Hubert St. Germain. The one is scary, and the other isn't.
And it seems more to do with genuine love.
Yeah, genuine love, and also in reaction to, you know, what is a humiliating marriage in many ways.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you a question about the construction of the novel or the pace of it. It began quite slowly for me. Mm-hmm. And also I felt as if I was at a distance from the characters. It was almost as if, you know, in the early one of the first scenes of the book, you have Jordan coming in on an airplane, and Vanessa is watching him from afar, and he's coming closer and closer. And I, as a reader, felt like that. And there was a certain point in the book where I went from saying, do I really care about these characters, to caring about them completely. It really built in intensity and in pace, and I felt it was a beautifully constructed novel.
Oh, good.
Is this something that you paid a lot of attention to, or did this just did it just happen?
Both. Yes. You can pay all kinds of attention to it, it still won't happen. And you can pay no attention to it, and it'll happen. In this case, I guess both. Yeah, I wanted to try to tell as much of the story as possible from the air. I know how absurd that sounds, but you know, I live up there in the mountain, and that particular region seems to be almost always viewed best from high up, either on the side of a mountain or the top of a mountain, or even from a little airplane. And I had flown around with a friend up there, and I had become fascinated by that particular point of view and was looking for the literary equivalent of it. And one of the reasons why it's written in the, you know, in that omniscient third-person narrator, it's a godlike view of these lives, these four lives. And I wanted to be able to move in and move out of them and with ease, and switch from one to the other with ease. So that was all very deliberate and conscious. And also I wanted to start slowly and from a distance and move in gradually on each of the characters, that we would first see the character from a distance and not quite get them, and then only gradually begin to become intimate with them and get them, without losing track of how they were perceived from outside. The pacing picked up, as you say, and the intensification of it increased as the story went on. And I suppose that's characteristic of a four-handed story, too, and you get four characters connected, as these four are, and lying to each other and moving around each other. The paces and the complexities and complications of it are going to get generated pretty fast. And that's what, for me, at a certain point, I was just trying to keep up with everything.
Well,
in the meantime, we're switching away to, you know, a year later to the Spanish Civil War and flying over Spain and also to the Hindenburg and the rise of fascism in Europe. So there's a lot to keep track of.
That's right. There are these kind of foreshadowing elements of things that are going to happen in the future, but the book doesn't really, they're not within the scope of the book.
No, and I think I was trying in some ways to both connect these people's individual lives and the drama unfolding on this lake up in the Adirondacks to what's going on in the big world, the much larger historical world, because I think that's how we live our lives. We're barely aware of it. It is a shadow hanging over us.
Yes, and I also found that the book was a look within the human heart, and one that I could, I could relate to many points of this, of the book, feeling that you were talking about things that I think about and yet I don't share with others.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, is especially of on the very last page almost, Hubert is thinking about how ultimately we're all really alone, and he doesn't know what is in Alicia's mind or heart. And he also has just really been on a process of discovering what's in his own heart.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a central theme, I hope, runs through it, is the ultimate unknowability of another human being, but through the course of trying to know another human being, learning what's in your own heart. That's exactly what I was hoping occurs in the course of this novel.
Well, Russell Banks, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Russell Banks. His new novel, The Reserve, is out from Harper's this month. You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Next up, we talk with Tamima Annam about her terrific debut novel, A Golden Age. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. When Tamima Annam went back to her native Bangladesh to do research for her doctoral thesis in anthropology, she gathered testimony from scores of survivors of Bangladesh's 1971 War of Independence from Pakistan. The conflict occurred 4 years before she was born, and she left the country at the age of two, living in Europe and America, and eventually attending Mount Holyoke College right here in western Massachusetts. Her novel, A Golden Age, returns to Bangladesh's struggle to become independent to tell the story of one family, a mother and her two children, both on the brink of adulthood. Rahana Haque is drawn by her children into the struggle, partly to pay off a decade-old debt to them. A debt incurred, Rahana feels, when she had to give them up for several years while they were still quite small after she was widowed. The novel is a sensitive foray into the bonds of family and patriotism in the best sense of the word, and how the two intersect. Associate producer Michael Pollitt and I spoke with Tamima Annam last week. Her book is The Golden Age. Tamima Annam, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, in your book, your novel, A Golden Age, this is the story of a family living and fighting through the War of Independence for Bangladesh, which used to be part of Pakistan. Could you give us kind of a quick synopsis of how Pakistan came into being as a country that was separated? It was like two wings sitting on either side of India.
That's exactly right. What happened was that when the British left India after having colonized it for 200 years, they left behind not one but two countries, India, which was a secular republic, and Pakistan, which was based on the idea of a kind of Muslim homeland for the sort of Muslim population in the subcontinent. And it was a very oddly shaped country because it was based on demographics, on the concentration of Muslims in the area, and so there was West Pakistan on one side of India and East Pakistan on the other side of India, and these two regions were divided not only by 1,000 miles of India, but also by language, by culture, by ethnicity. So as you can imagine, this country really didn't work, and that's really why we had the Bangladesh War in 1971.
You had different languages, as you say.
Absolutely, and in fact, soon after the independence of Pakistan, Urdu was imposed as the national language of the entire country. But Urdu was not spoken by anyone in the Eastern Wing, you know, by 98% of the people in the Eastern Wing. So that was a very big sign to them from the very beginning that they weren't going to be equal partners in this nation, that they were going to always be sort of the kind of poor relation, I suppose you could say. And this kind of really kicked off the tensions between the two wings.
Now, this is also a very personal story of a mother who, as the story begins, has lost her children. I wanted to ask, why has this happened, and also is this a kind of metaphor for the larger context of the book?
Well, the Rahana losing her children, the name of the main character is Rahana Haque, it's sort of the major event of her adult life, and it really helps to explain all the decisions that she makes throughout the war and throughout the novel. Her relationship with her children is not just one of kind of maternal love and protection, but also of a sense of guilt that she feels. She says that she feels indebted to her children because she allowed them to be taken away from her. And so every time they ask her for something, she can't say no, even though it goes against her instincts. So when they ask her, can we please get involved in the war, she can't say no. And then slowly, slowly, she starts to get sucked into this movement through her kind of relationship with her children.
Tamima, in the acknowledgments in your book, you mention the many stories of the war that your parents told you.
Yes.
Now, is your novel made up of these stories? Is this in large part or a very small part about your family during this time?
Well, some of the stories are about my family. I didn't grow up in Bangladesh. My father was a diplomat with the UN, so we moved all over the world. And one of the ways that they helped me to stay connected to Bangladesh was to tell me stories about the war. And both my parents had been in the war. Their families had been very involved, all of their friends. So I did grow up listening to stories about the war. And some of those stories made it into the book. The character of Rahana is loosely based on my maternal grandmother, who was also widowed at a young age, and her house became the center of one of the centers of the resistance in the city. And, you know, if you met her, you wouldn't think that she would have been capable of being such a kind of revolutionary, but she kind of really got caught up in the movement because of her children, i.e. my mother and my mother's brother.
Now, you were born in Bangladesh.
I was.
And you left when you were two. Why did you leave, and then why did you go back?
As I said, my parents were both working for the UN, so my father first got posted to Paris. So we moved to Paris when I was only 2 years old, and then we lived in various countries. We lived in the United States for a while. We lived in Thailand, and then when I was 15, my parents decided to move back to Bangladesh because they still had that kind of spirit because they had been in the war, and they would always, no matter what country we lived in, they would always say, oh, no, you know, we're not staying here. We're going to move back to Bangladesh. It was always something that they were very keen on doing. And my father ended up starting one of the first politically neutral daily newspapers in the country, which is now a very successful English daily newspaper. So he's a journalist, a very kind of prominent figure in the media because he's been standing up to the government, and he's very outspoken, and my mother runs a human rights aid organization. So I'm very connected to Bangladesh, and I have always, even when I came to Mount Holyoke for university and went on to graduate school in Massachusetts, I always was very connected to Bangladesh, and I go home two or three times a year. And specifically to do my doctoral research on the Bangladesh War, I went home for 2 years. I traveled all over the country. I interviewed many, many survivors of the war.
What were the things that most inspired your interest in writing a novel about this that came out of the research that you did?
Well, what happened was that I went to Bangladesh thinking that I was doing a kind of oral history project. And I met so many fascinating people, and I heard so many stories, and I was so moved. I was so emotionally kind of transformed by this, by hearing these stories, and I thought the only way that I would really be able to convey something of that tone, something of that intensity, would be to write fiction, because fiction is the, you know, the sort of method we use to transport ourselves to another time and place, and no other form of writing can really do that. So that's why I chose to write a novel.
And it's a novel that takes place during the war, but it's not really about the war. It's really about the family struggles, Rahana Haque's struggles to survive the war and to keep her family intact. You have a wonderful way of letting us know that it was a horrible war, and yet you don't concentrate on the gore of it. I wonder if that was difficult for you to do that and not try to expose the atrocities. How did you stay with a fictional account that way?
Well, I think it's very difficult to try to balance these different interest when you write a historical novel. You know, how much of the history do you provide? How much of the kind of political backdrop or the sort of, you know, journalistic instinct to describe the brutality of the war? Those are all sort of competing interests. But I really wanted to write a novel about how ordinary people survived this war. What happened to them? How they were changed? How their relationships with one another were changed? And you sort of get a sense of what's going on because various people in Rahana's life either are disappeared or they are killed, and you only see some of the violence close up when she goes to rescue this particular prisoner of war from a camp, and you sort of see what's happened to him and that he's been tortured. But that's really, I wanted to make sure that you sort of stayed in Rahana's perspective, and she was very much confined to her home and very much just concerned with saving her children. And this is really the focus of the book, because as I said, I wanted to make the book about, not about a soldier or about a politician or about this war in a kind of abstract sense, but very specifically about this very ordinary woman and how she's kind of, how she becomes a sort of revolutionary through her experiences in this war.
Tell us more about Rahana. Tell us more about her character and her struggles and how being a mother is so involved with her decision to become part of the resistance. You alluded to that before, but tell us more about that.
Well, Rahana is, I mean, one of the main things about her is that she's actually not from Bangladesh. She's from Calcutta, which means that she speaks Urdu, and that makes her a bit of an outsider. And the reason I did that was because I actually thought the novel was going to be about Rahana's children, because they were the real revolutionaries. They were the people that were fighting in the battles. And then I decided that actually it's a more interesting journey to follow somebody who's not, at first, a kind of natural patriot. You know, she doesn't feel the same things for Bangladesh as her children feel. But it's because she loves her children, she wants to be a part of their struggle, that she sort of slowly gets drawn in. And by the end, she has a completely different relationship to the country than she did in the beginning. And one of the reasons I did that was because, actually, having not grown up in Bangladesh myself, I think some of Rehana's feelings about the place, of ambivalence, about not really fitting in, echo some of my own feelings. And to me, that felt like a much more honest place from which to tell the story.
And did you grow up speaking, which language?
Bengali. I did grow up speaking Bengali, although it's very difficult, as you can imagine, because I went to English schools and English was the language that I conversed in with my teachers and my friends. It was difficult for my parents to maintain my Bengali. I had Bengali tutors. They spoke to me in Bengali at home all the time. But at this moment, I mean, people in Bangladesh ask me, why didn't you write this book in Bengali? And I have to admit that my Bengali isn't good enough for me to have written a novel. My English is much better than my Bengali.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tamima Anam about her novel, A Golden Age. It's about a family during the time of the liberation movement of Bangladesh from Pakistan. Now, I wanted to get back to Rehana and her family. She's got two children, an older son, Sohail, and a younger daughter, Maya. She's got a fairly troubled relationship with her daughter. Tell us, why did you portray that? Why is she so much closer to her son? And what are the difficulties with her daughter?
Well, I was thinking about actually my own experience of that culture, of South Asian culture, where because male children are kind of favored in society, women often have these very adoring and very simple relationships with their sons where they just kind of indulge them. And Rehana doesn't really realize that she's done this, but one of her friends points out to her that she's been so much less forgiving of her daughter, and her daughter isn't as easy to love. She's much more brittle and kind of hard, and whereas her son is a very sweet-natured, kind of romantic figure. It's a very unproblematic relationship. He asks her for things, and she can't say no. With her daughter, I think her daughter has more stakes in kind of trying to contradict or overcome the sorts of, you know, traditions that she sees that her mother has not been able to overcome. And so I think that kind of generational gap is much more kind of apparent with the daughter, whereas with the son it's a much more uncomplicated relationship. So I wanted to explore that a little bit in the novel.
I wanted to ask you for a comment on, there was a review of the book in the Times this past Sunday, I'd like to just ask you about one part that it puzzled me as well. There's a place in which her daughter Maya talks to her mother about how, you know, all the kids at the university are having sex, mm-hmm. all the women are having sex. And to mm-hmm. me, I thought to myself, you know, wow, would somebody in that culture say that to her mm-hmm. mother? Mm-hmm. And I guess the reviewer had the same question, so I'm going to ask you to respond to that.
Sure. The thing is, in that moment, Maya has just found out that her friend was raped, and that she was raped by a Pakistani soldier. She was kept as a kind of, you know, and this happened during the Bangladesh War, women were kept as the sexual slaves of the Pakistani soldiers. And there were many kind of rape camps that were discovered. It's a very terrible thing about the war that was only discovered afterwards, and all these women had been kept imprisoned in the army barracks for the months of the war, throughout the 9 months. And Maya's friend died in one of those camps. So partly the reason she says that is because she's so angry, and it's this kind of brutal moment, and she says the most outrageous thing she can think of at that moment. And if you can think back of in times in your life when you're so angry, you just say the worst thing you can think of. And so she says everyone's having sex, but she wasn't. And I think that kind of alludes to the fact that there was a kind of sexual freedom in the 60s that even permeated to a place like Bangladesh. And maybe it's not very comfortable for us to think about, you know, to sort of challenge the notions that we have of that particular society as being quite conservative and very closed. But I do believe, and of course I wasn't there, that some of that consciousness, especially, I mean, certainly the politics that people were talking about students in the 60s all over the world was very similar. And there's no reason why the kind of liberties that people took in not necessarily being as sexually free as they were in the West, but certainly talking about these things. And for her, that moment, she wants to utter the most outrageous and kind of dramatic thing she can to her mother because she's so angry. And that's why I put that line in.
So teenagers are the same all over the world, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah.
Tamima, you know, there's a saying that you should be careful about what you wish for because mm-hmm. you may get it, but maybe not how you wanted to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And your novel seems to me to give us a lot of that saying. Rahana is able to keep her family mm-hmm. together mm-hmm. in the end. Her son, Sohail, does become a man. She, I'm not going to say what it is, but mm-hmm. she has a secret and she's able to release her secret. But in very strange and sometimes tragic ways. Mm-hmm. Tell us, were you aware of that in your writing? What was...
Well, I suppose on a larger scale, I was thinking about all of these people dreaming of a country and really believing that they could create something that was completely new, something that their imaginations were kind of pure because this was a new start for them, a new beginning. And as we know, the last 37 years have not been kind to Bangladesh. We've had many disasters, both man-made and natural. And that's why I called the book A Golden Age, because I think for a lot of people who survived that time, they look back on it. Of course, it was a terrible tragedy, and many, many people lost their lives, and we must never forget that. But for the people who survived it, I think they look back and think, wow, this is really what we wanted. We wanted a new country. And for whatever reasons, many that were beyond their control, many of those hopes were dashed. So I suppose it is a case of careful what you wish for, because this is what they wanted. They wanted their country, and then they had to take responsibility for it, which wasn't very easy.
Mm.
And we're speaking with Tamima Anam about her debut novel, A Golden Age. Now, I wanted to say I found the writing very mature, more mature than in most debut novels, I think. And so did you study writing, or where did this come from?
I did do an MFA in creative writing. The thing about writing school, at least in my experience, is that it's the most unstructured kind of training you can get, because it's all about the response that you get from your peers. And for me, it was an excellent way of really deciding where my stakes were. You know, that I really wanted to write this novel, and this was, and that's from the very first day, that's what I set out to do. And, you know, that was a very wonderful experience, but I have to say, if there are any merits in the book, those merits come from the story that I had to tell. And I feel that, you know, I sort of inherited the story, not just from my family, but from all the people that were so generous in sharing their experiences with me. And all I had to do was kind of find a way to tell it, really. And that was my privilege.
I wanted to ask you another question. Just historically, there's a certain point in the book where Maya goes to Calcutta, and her mother joins her there, and they work together in a refugee camp.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about these refugee camps, and
yeah.
There's a very stark experience there. And tell us a little bit about them, and did you draw on some of the stories that you had heard from the people you talked with for this part of the book?
Absolutely. I think the part in Calcutta, the time when they go to the refugee camps, I really had to rely a lot on people's testimonies for that, and also photographs of the camps, which are available in Bangladesh. The scene where it's a field of unused sewer pipes, these giant lengths of pipe that people live in. And I've seen photographs of the camps where people were actually living in those pipes, so that's definitely from kind of documentary evidence. And yes, people, how they got to Calcutta, you know, the train route that Rahana took, that was taken from many people's testimonies of how they got out of Bangladesh and how they smuggled themselves across the border. And, you know, 10 million people fled across the border to India. It was one of the biggest movements of people in history in such a short amount of time. And, of course, this created an immense humanitarian disaster, basically. So that's where I got the information for that part of the story.
And the Hindus were targeted.
Absolutely. Now, you know, the Pakistan army had to use a particular kind of rhetoric to get the soldiers to commit this brutality on these civilians, because essentially the Bangladesh war was an organized army against a civilian population, a very poorly armed civilian population, which is why the casualty rate was so high. And they told the soldiers, you are fighting a battle for Islam, because this country was, the whole raison d'etre of this country was to have a Muslim country. And if these people want to break away from this Muslim country, they must not be true Muslims. They're doing something against the religion. And therefore, the Hindus were the first people that were targeted. But then even the Muslims were targeted. They were set, you know, they were told, the soldiers were told, these are not real Muslims, so you can kill them. It's not like you're killing your brothers. So there definitely was a very high degree of religious rhetoric during the war.
Tamima, I wonder if you would read a page in your novel to
sure.
us?
Sure. Is there a particular page you had in mind?
There is. Page 130.
130?
Yes, page 130. It's the middle paragraph, starting there, and then just finish the paragraph that ends on page 131.
On days when her nerves threatened to overwhelm her, Rahana tried to think back to a less turbulent time, when nothing of significance happened, when the passing of seasons, the thrill of the Eid moon sighting, the smell of mangoes ripening on the trees were the most spectacular events of the calendar. But their lives had never had any regularity, at least not the sort Rahana was now sifting her memories for. There was always something, some uproar in the city or beyond, in Islamabad, where one punishing law after another was passed, and even further afield, the death of Che Guevara, who Sohail had mourned as though he had lost a brother. Every hiccup of the political landscape made its way to their door, and when her son was old enough, came through the door and into the bungalow, into the boy's drawn and serious face, the shadows he cast upon the corridors and over the dining table, and then into Maya, who was angrier and louder. No, there had never been any other time. Their lives were populated by Lenin and Castro and Mujib and Anwar Sadat. There was only this time, this life, this fraught and crowded era, to which they were bound without choice, without knowledge, only their passions, their loves, to lead and sustain them.
That's a very beautiful section, and I also thought about how much we all struggle to keep our lives together even when we're not in war, and even more so people who are in war, to maintain the normalcy of their lives. I wonder if you could say just something about, if you could just say more about this passage and kind of what it brought up for you.
Well, actually, this passage refers to the ways in which the people in Bangladesh were connected to the rest of the world in the 60s. And it sort of is connected to what I said before about Maya and her sexuality. You know, we think that the world is moving towards more and more globalization and more connectedness, and that's definitely true. But I think that there was something about that time. There were so many movements for national independence. There was a very big protest against the Vietnam War in this country. And people really felt tied to one another through these struggles and because they were imagining a different world. So really, this passage, and there are some other moments in the book where I'm trying to get at is that, you know, this is not an isolated country, even though we might think of it that way today because of the poverty and because, you know, all we read about Bangladesh in the papers is about one disaster after another. That at this moment, there was a sense that there was something universal, something shared about the ways in which people were imagining the future.
Well, Tamima Anam, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
It's also a great pleasure for me. Thanks, Tamima.
Thank you, Michael.
That was Tamima Anam talking with us about her debut novel, a wonderful novel called A Golden Age.
Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming authors at our website, writersvoice.net. You can also find links there to their books, and you can listen to or download past shows. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.